Hey everyone, I'm Jordan from New St. Andrews College. I'd like to invite you to join us for one of our upcoming prospective student weekends. We have one on March 2nd and 3rd, and another from April 13th to 16th. To learn more and to register your visit, check us out online at nsa.edu. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Today's disputatio is, it's becoming an annual economics disputatio, connected to courses that Dr. McIntosh teaches. And this year's disputatio is done by the junior class, the ones that Mrs. Howell doesn't like very much. And I'm going to hand over, and those who are participating, please come and sit up on the stage, and James Good will introduce the topic to us. Please welcome the junior class.
All right, everybody in order? Okay. So, when you get to be a junior, you get to take economics and politics from Dr. McIntosh. If you're a senior, too bad. You missed it. But in that class, you get to learn about all sorts of interesting things. And when you run out of interesting things to talk about, you talk about other interesting things. And one of the interesting things that we decided we wanted to talk about is cryptocurrency. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the junior class political and economics disputatio on cryptocurrency and its effects on you. So, without further ado, I'm going to lead off with why in the world you should care. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the moment you've waited for. The disputatio on cryptocurrency. I am sure you have eagerly anticipated the chance to sit down, pull out your notebooks, wait for me to open my mouth, and ignore me while you do homework. Unfortunately for you, they picked the guy with the stentorian voice to lead off, so my job is to make that difficult. But I understand, I really do. Before I'd taken this economics class, if you'd come up to me in the commons and went, you wanna learn about some Bitcoin? I would've gone, you don't wanna talk to me about Bitcoin. You wanna go home and rethink your life. But Bitcoin, or cryptocurrency in general, is part of your life now. And right now, your life centers around the liberal arts. So what exactly does cryptocurrency have to do with the liberal arts? Well, the answer, if I can quote Paul out of context, is to say much in every way. Cryptocurrency, in one sentence, is an anonymous, virtual, instantaneous form of payment that isn't controlled by banks, governments, or third parties. And unlike most online media, and I'm using media here in the broad sense, everything from your checking account to cat videos on YouTube, it cannot be duplicated by any reasonably educated keyboard ninja, which is important when you're dealing with money, because if the other guy can just go print more of it online, then your money's not worth a whole lot. So the word I've seen most often in the articles about cryptocurrency and the new technology that drives it is revolutionary. Now, true, that's merely a buzzword. But if we really are supposed to be shapers of culture, then we have to learn to distinguish the true revolutions, fireworks and all, from the smoke and mirrors. That's what good little liberal artists, to quote Mr. Jankovic, do. And that is why we're here today. Imagine that you were at hand and paying attention the first time someone discovered steel, or invented the printing press, or sent the first email. That could be lucrative and influential. Cryptocurrency might be the same. Bitcoin, for instance, in the last 3 years has multiplied its own value against the US dollar by 33 times. Now that may sound more like a bubble or a fad than a sure investment. Nobody wants to get caught in the newest stock market crash that starts the second Great Depression. But that means that even if cryptocurrency isn't that big a deal, and it may not be, you can't afford to ignore it now. even if you never want to get near a cryptocurrency, figuratively. A closer look can show you some interesting things by contrast about the currency you put in your savings account right now. Oh, wait, you're college students. Okay, your Square Cash account right now. It could tell you something about the governments who control that money and about the people who fear those controlling governments. It can tell you something about the culture around us that created just such an artifact. What is cryptocurrency's context? Its causes. Its consequences. We can't just jump on this because it's new and shiny in the pixels that are on your smartphone. But on the other hand, in 10 years, if you're a deacon in the local church and your newest member wants to pay his tithe in Bitcoin or an equivalent, will you just stare at him blankly? Drool a little bit? What if it's the easiest, safest way to pay for a third world adoption that you've longed for years because its blockchain is theft proof and it can't be taken? And you'll learn about that later. The liberal arts, in part, is to train you to look at a wide variety of facts and situations and eras and then assess them. Our class today is here to help you out with that process. We've put in some time, effort, and hopefully fun into our education and yours. We hope you repay us becoming wiser in the open secrets of cryptocurrency. Whether you ever need to hire an assassin on the dark web, or you just want to avoid the government shoving its grabby pokey hands into your purse, this dispy is for you. I still may not buy your Bitcoin, but at least now you'll know why.
What is cryptocurrency? Where did it come from? And how was it created? If you're beginning to feel overwhelmed by this topic and aren't understanding what we are talking about, have no fear, for I am the Neradio of Disputatio. Albert Einstein once said that if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. So let's see how simple I can make it. Cryptocurrency is a recent fad that exploded into the mainstream, and the system that started it all was none other than Bitcoin, the first programmable currency. What is Bitcoin? Where did it come from? Where will it go? Where did it come from? Satoshi Nakamoto. On Halloween of 2008, Bitcoin was released by a man or a group, we're not really quite sure which, called Satoshi Nakamoto, whose main agenda was to provide a new type of currency, a currency that was completely digitized. Bitcoin, in its early stages, was mainly used for online purchases of rather sketchy materials, like drugs, illegal weapons, or other various black market objects, due to its ability to keep the purchaser completely anonymous. Then it hit the mainstream, and now there are thousands of companies who are beginning to accept Bitcoin as a valid form of currency. Bitcoin, the most interesting part of Bitcoin is that it does not require a centralized system, as James was saying. One that runs off of banks, governments, or any other type of third-party system. The ability to decentralize is all thanks to a technology called blockchain, which is a universal ledger system that everyone has access to, allowing them to confirm the validity of the currency traded to them, as well as be able to see where it was last sent to. Imagine if we all had a copy of the clipboard that gets passed around. And imagine that it was completely up to date on who was robed and who wasn't, and who was here and who wasn't. If I went and changed one of those copies, say I say, oh, I'm robed when I wasn't, then you would all be able to look at your clipboard and be like, mm-mm, doesn't say that. And then, therefore, prevent that lie from spreading throughout the rest of Disputatio. This is how blockchain affects Bitcoin, and it is how it keeps it from being counterfeited. Unlike the centralized system where either a government or a bank official must validate the currency and deem it worthy of trade, Bitcoin, through its use of blockchain, allows everyone to immediately check to see if the currency they are receiving is valid. There are three methods of obtaining Bitcoin. The first is that you can buy it with physical money. Second, you can exchange Bitcoin for goods and services. And third, you can mine it. Not this kind of mining, though. Soak it in. The whole mining process consists of algorithms that are run on computers in order to solve complex mathematical problems that, when solved, will unlock a new block. Inside these blocks are the rewards of new bitcoins, which are added to your virtual wallet when you unlock the block. And when these new blocks are opened, they are added to the chain and everyone gets the ability to validate whether they are authentic bitcoins and be able to check what was inside that blockchain originally. Basically, the miners are those who pick the locks of the treasure chest containing bitcoins. But then imagine the treasure chest having a system where it tells you exactly where those bitcoins are after every transaction and what engraving it should have on it in order to be valid. You may all be thinking to yourselves, since when did Stalker become an expert on cryptocurrency and blockchain? To which my answer is last night. Being that Bitcoin is programmable, or programmable currency, meaning we can program it to do whatever we want, or only to be spent on certain things, this opens up the ability to trust those whom we send our money to, without knowing them personally. Imagine a GoFundMe page where when you send your money, you could be 100% positive that the Bitcoin you sent would only be used to buy food for third world countries, or whatever it is that you decided to support. It is programmed into the Bitcoin you sent, which is pretty neato. It also opens a huge door to fully automated machines being able to completely manage themselves, even when it comes to purchasing the things they need, including maintenance or ordering materials they need, or really anything that a manager would do at a factory. This should completely terrify you, because much like the printing press did to all the peasants in the 15th century. Thank you.
I don't have any pictures like that. But I do know that in order to understand cryptocurrency, we first need to know what currency is in general. It's important to note that any good can be used as a currency, but there are some... Ooh. But there are some generally acknowledged characteristics that naturally favor the use of a good as a currency. The first of which is that a good should be widely marketable. A good is considered more marketable than another when it has more uses. This is the chief prerequisite of a good becoming money. The following qualities follow under this criterion, in that they increase the marketability of a good. A good should also be easily transportable. The easier it is to transport a good, the better its marketability. For instance, gold is a better currency than land is because it can be transported, whereas land cannot. To become money, a good should also be relatively scarce. This criterion goes hand in hand with transportability, since the more of a good there is in a certain area, the less valuable it is per unit. Larger quantities are harder to transport than smaller ones. Accordingly, if dirt were a commodity, it would take a truckload to buy a gallon of milk. A good should also be relatively imperishable. Following the same analogy, milk would not be an ideal currency, since it goes bad more quickly than something like gold does. The more imperishable your money, the longer it retains value. A good should also be easy to store. The easier it is to store a good, the easier it is to transport and exchange. In this regard, livestock is not as desirable as cash, since cash can be stored in one's wallet and a cow cannot. Second to last here is the criterion of the divisibility of the good. If the commodity is easily divisible, you can make change with it. Gems fall short in this regard, since by dividing them, you destroy their value. And finally, each unit of the good should be very similar to every other unit of the same commodity. If each unit of currency is relatively similar to all other units, the value of the currency is easier to pin down. Diamonds do not make an ideal currency in this regard because the value of a diamond varies widely depending on its size and quality. So each of these qualities play a role in determining what turns a medium of exchange into a currency. Money itself originates when a medium of exchange fits into these seven categories better than other commodities around it. So now that we understand currency in general, somebody else is going to help us take a look at the specifics. Thanks.
All right. All right. So now that we've talked about what money is, let's talk about the money in your pocket. Likely, many of you have a debit card, or if you're old school, you might even carry around cash. As helpfully demonstrated by this visual aid, your money has no value. Now, that's not entirely true. The catch is, your money only has value as long as you continue to believe it has value. Let's take a look at how we got here. The United States currency at one point consisted primarily of gold and silver coins. Now, during the Civil War, the US government introduced fiat currency into the economy for the first time due to ballooning war expenses and debts. Now, these issued bills were not redeemable for silver or gold. Instead, their value was based on the government's word alone. Shortly after the war ended, the US adopted the gold standard, which provided a gold backing for the paper currency already in circulation. This more or less stayed in effect until 1933, when Roosevelt recalled gold and made it illegal for US citizens to own gold, and this forced them to use the US bill as currency alone. The final blow came in 1971, when Nixon completely severed the fixed rate between the US dollar and gold, allowing the dollar's relationship to gold to fluctuate according to market exchange. Now, this brings us up to the current day, where the money we carry in our pockets has no intrinsic value. The dollar is not based on any sort of commodity like gold. Rather, the value is based solely on the word of the government. It's crucial here to make the distinction between paper currency and fiat currency. Not all paper money is fiat. During the time of the gold standard, remember, paper bills floated in circulation, but they were 100% backed by gold. The bills we use today, however, are fiat because their value only comes from the backing of the government. The currencies may seem nearly identical, but the difference has enormous implications for the future of money. Fiat currency brings along a host of problems, and if we understand these problems, we can see why cryptocurrency is put forth as an alternative. One of the crucial issues with fiat money is the problem of trust. In order for a fiat currency to be sustainable, it requires trust in the issuer, trust in the system, and trust in those around you to honor that system. Because fiat currency has no inherent value, the currency loses all viability if confidence is lost in any of these areas. Today, the dollar appears stable, but its stability is an illusion. Because the dollar's value is based only on the government's word, the dollar is only as stable as long as that trust remains. Cryptocurrency offers a unique solution to this issue of trust because it's completely decentralized, instead of requiring you to trust in a central authority. At the present time, cryptocurrency is itself not a stable currency, but advocates claim that if it becomes the main form of currency, the system would even out and become stable. Another related problem with fiat currency is the government's ability to debase the currency. If you'll remember back to the seven characteristics that make a commodity a good currency, one of them is relative scarcity. The US government has a monopoly over the supply of money in the economy. It is often in their interest and within their ability to print and spend as much money as they want. This is a sneaky way of spending money without raising taxes. So, in other words, maybe it isn't just an issue of whether we can put so much trust in a central authority, but of whether that trust is even warranted. Another problem that occurs as a result of inflation is that, as Voltaire puts it, paper money eventually returns to its intrinsic value, which is zero. As the government continues to inflate the bills in circulation, the value of each one will continue to drop until confidence altogether drops. This problem, which we call hyperinflation, can be avoided within a cryptocurrency. Take Bitcoin, for example. The inflation rate of Bitcoin is extremely low and will eventually drop to zero, so owners of Bitcoin don't have to worry about the value dropping due to inflation. The value of Bitcoin lies not in the declaration of an authority, but in the usefulness of the system. So as long as people continue to value the usefulness, the currency remains viable. Fiat money is problematic because it relies on trust in a single authority. The money you carry in your pocket only has value as long as you continue to trust the government and those around you to also value the dollar. Cryptocurrency is offered as a potential solution to these problems because it is decentralized and its value is not dependent on a single issuing party. Whether it is a viable solution or a passing fad will be up to us to decide.
All right. Now we move on to the subject of the economic implications of cryptocurrency. We can consider such questions as, what is the value of cryptocurrency as money, as medium of exchange in the market? Why is the value of Bitcoin so volatile? Is it therefore a good investment or not? So firstly, extending the comments of Ms. Taylor regarding the relationship between cryptocurrency and fiat currency and inflation, we can note a few things about the stability of cryptocurrency's money supply. As previously noted, in comparison with fiat currency, the size of the currency pool for cryptocurrency is incredibly stable because there's a hard cap on growth. For example, Bitcoin can only be divided so into increments that are so small, actually 100 million parts per coin. They're called the Satoshi after the creator of Bitcoin. And only so many Bitcoin can come into existence, 21 million, by the fiat of the creators of the algorithms that govern the software. And because they're so decentralized, as we've heard, government regulation is a lot more difficult because individuals are governing each Bitcoin rather than the government. Now, one thing that's important to note is that governments can potentially still change the hard cap for currencies if they can successfully regulate or control the computing power that's used in mining. So we haven't found a currency that has completely eliminated any possibility of government control. This isn't necessarily a terrible thing, though. Remember that we're not trying to find a currency that can't be manipulated by the government. What we're trying to do is find a currency that can better meet our needs here in the 21st century than fiat currency, that's more stable than fiat currency. This brings us to the subject of cryptocurrency as a means of exchange that I can actually use in day-to-day transactions when I go to the grocery store, check out on Amazon.com. Right now, most cryptocurrency, with a few exceptions, is still viewed primarily as something you exchange for other currencies, although there is a large and growing list of companies that are beginning to accept Bitcoin directly, actually. So the question is, does cryptocurrency have the potential to become a money like the pound or the dollar or something else that people use on a daily basis? First of all, notice that anything has the potential to be a medium of exchange if it's agreed upon by all the parties in a transaction. We've already heard about the different characteristics that make up a good money. Fiat currency presents a number of problems with international trade, exchange rates, stability due to government-induced inflation that cryptocurrency attempts to solve. So for this reason, cryptocurrency is valuable to many people who view it as being more stable and less tied to a central regulatory group or state. One thing that's notably different with cryptocurrency, however, is that it's not a commodity like gold or silver is prior to its status as money. Gold and silver are valuable to people whether or not they're used as money. For example, I can't go out and buy my groceries with a bar of gold, but that fact doesn't change the thing that it's still valuable. I can still sell it for dollars. On the other hand, if cryptocurrency can't be exchanged for an accepted currency, if people don't value cryptocurrency, then it's just worthless. However, cryptocurrency seeks to imitate commodity currency like gold or silver insofar as it seeks to provide a stable pool of money that's secure from the depredations of greedy governments or hackers. This has led some people to argue that the primary use of cryptocurrency is as a metacurrency, that is, a form of currency that you only use to trade for other kinds of currency. This is actually especially valuable for trade in countries that have no or an extremely unstable central bank or currency, especially in the third world. They can escape their unstable economies and trade freely using relatively stable cryptocurrency on the international market. Finally, we turn to cryptocurrency as an investment. Speaking of metacurrency and its valuable, whether or not it's valuable as that, we can look at the price of Bitcoin. We can see that it's changing all the time. It's extremely volatile. It's like betting on the price of gasoline, but even worse. So this seems to indicate that it's not really stable as a currency, right? Well, I think it's important to make a distinction between the volatility of cryptocurrency as an investment, where you're just betting on the exchange rate, and as a currency that you use in your daily life. Two examples. First of all, note the price of gold is always changing. We often think of gold as being a bad investment, but a good currency. Another example, imagine the volatility of the US dollar if the only point of having US dollars was to exchange them for the British pound. Well, the value of the dollar would constantly fluctuate because it would only depend on not what you're buying, but just on people that are betting the exchange rate will continue to be good. So therefore, in many ways, the more widely accepted cryptocurrency becomes to purchase consumer goods, the more stable it will be, as its value will be more and more tied to what you can actually buy with it, rather than the whims of speculators seeking to exchange it for another more constant in value currency. A potential issue with the decentralization of cryptocurrency is that there's a vast proliferation of different sorts of cryptocurrencies. A world that fully adopted cryptocurrency would be a market in which different currencies would need to be constantly exchanged for others. Then, is adopting cryptocurrency economically feasible in the market? Well, some would view the uselessness of cryptocurrency as a commodity prior to its use as money as a disadvantage. They want to see a currency more grounded in the material world, either for reasons of theology and natural law or more practical concerns with putting so much stock in relatively ephemeral digital technology. But all these questions of ethics and philosophy, I'll leave to the presenters who come after me. Thank you.
Cryptocurrencies have issues, and if they're to succeed in the long run, we need to deal with them. These issues can be divided into two main categories, international and domestic. International, because cryptocurrencies are exchanged on the internet, can go between countries. Because governments still want a say in cryptocurrency, they interfere. So first, there's positive interference, in which governments promote or encourage specific cryptocurrencies. Some examples of this are the Portuguese crypto escudo, the German Dutch D-mark, or the Icelandic Aurora coin. Secondly, there's negative interference, ways in which governments regulate or ban cryptocurrencies or specific practices within the cryptocurrency industry, like China's ban of initial coin offerings. Banning cryptocurrencies makes them less convenient for the average user and can drive the currency's use underground. But why do governments bother banning them in the first place? Well, it can stem from a desire to protect their citizens. Cryptocurrencies have issues. This leads us to the more proximate issues surrounding cryptocurrency, the domestic issues. Firstly, cryptocurrencies are in many ways untraceable. This can facilitate criminal ventures. Why not hire a hitman or an escort or demand a ransom or buy drugs and weaponry with a currency that is fairly anonymous? If there is no regulation of the currency, circumventing the laws is that much easier. But hold on a minute. No one here has the pressing need to finance a criminal empire. I hope. Remember, though, that cryptocurrency does not just apply to big-ticket buys. Take tax evasion, for instance. As Dr. Mack puts it, on the one hand, cryptocurrency makes tax evasion easier. On the other hand, it makes tax evasion easier. But how people use cryptocurrency is not the only side of the crime coin. Cryptocurrency is also rife with hacking and fraud. Not all cryptocurrencies are top shelf, like Bitcoin. Mom-and-pop cryptocurrencies, as I would call them, lack adequate technological security, leaving cracks that are easy for hackers to slip through. Coincheck alone lost $500 million to hackers. On top of that, some cryptocurrencies are nothing more than Ponzi schemes. Scammers sell initial coin offerings with no technology behind them. They simply rake in the profits from credulous investors and then abscond with the pot. My favorite example of this is the Proof of Weak Hands coin, which actually describes itself as a Ponzi scheme, and its logo is a pyramid. It managed to raise about $800,000, and then it was hacked. The cryptocurrency industry is full of high-level scammers and hackers because there are multitudes of credulous investors who are willing to risk much to gain quick money. Add to this the numerous zeros behind each dollar sign, and one begins to see the hacker's incentive. So there you have it. These are some of the issues surrounding cryptocurrency. We need to solve them in order for cryptocurrencies to become a feasible means of exchange. The question then becomes, where ought this regulation to come from? The government or the private sector? Doesn't the government have a duty to do so, to protect its citizens? If the government is to protect market justice, does it not have a legitimate vested interest in controlling the units of exchange? Alternatively, does the government even have the right to get involved? Oughtn't the private market be left to its own devices? Either way, we need to start talking.
I'll give you a second. Okay. To conclude this discussion, we get a lot drier. No, but we turn to theology and metaphysics. To be sure, any talk of cryptocurrency along these lines is likely to do less to provide answers than questions, but we can at least endeavor to raise the right ones. In this sense, my talk is not about what a Christian ought to think about cryptocurrency, but how. Perhaps the first question we should ask is, what is man really doing? What is cryptocurrency really? Is cryptocurrency simply a positive exercise in man's dominion over creation? Or is it a sort of economic Tower of Babel, a futile rebellion against the natural order? God created man with an ability to create things himself, and further, commanded him to take dominion over the rest of creation. Humans, as the innovators we are, have filled the world with our products and technological advances, thanks to this subcreative gift of God. It is clear, however, that this gift can, and has been, abused. Such was the case with the Tower of Babel, where men used their most advanced technology explicitly to go against God's command to fill the earth. Now, how could cryptocurrency be likened at all to that? A look at history may help us here. Church fathers like Augustine and theologians like Aquinas condemned the taking of usury, calling it charging for nothing. Yet today, this is a universally accepted practice in the form of interest, and has been for quite some time. Is cryptocurrency a similar phenomenon that will one day be widely accepted and normalized? Or is it really money for nothing? And if so, what is the problem with that? If the cryptocurrencies that now exist are effectively creating money from nothing, the problem would rest, it seems, on whether the value placed on them is natural or not, as one of the presenters mentioned earlier. Can man assign value arbitrarily, such that something with no previous value or even existence can be traded as currency? Or are there things that are made to be valued and things that are not? Is the mention in Genesis of the gold of Havilah, which was good, by the way, a reflection of some inherent value in gold, or a recognition of the subjective value that man places on it? Now, these are a lot of questions, I know, and they're not easily answered. But what are we left with then? Well, our thoughts on cryptocurrency, for one, can inform the way we view our own currency. The questions I've raised about it can inform the way, the questions I've raised apply to our own money just as well. The problems of nature and the origin of valuation are not found only in these new currencies, which have digital manifestations only, but plague our dollar, our euro, and our yen, which have paper money. In the end, it seems that whatever answers we give to the above questions must, if we are to be consistent, be the same for both existing cryptocurrencies and our own. Thank you.
How's your homework? We'll find out. All right, so now we get to take questions, of which I hope you have lots. And I will pick on some unfortunate panelists to answer your question. So, who's first? Oh, you're next, Michael. Bobby bites you.
So I wasn't exactly, I heard you guys kind of talking about this, but it wasn't exactly clear. What is the technical definition of a cryptocurrency? What separates Bitcoin from cash? How is it different?
Oh, goody. Okay, so a cryptocurrency is basically just digitalized money, which isn't much different from what we have now. I mean, I use Square Cash a lot. I use my credit card, my debit card, and we hardly ever deal with physical money unless you're one of the, you know, lucky people who do. And it's basically just a completely subjective value that we're like, oh yeah, we all agree that that cryptocurrency, that, you know, money we've designed to be limited in some level and very relatable to other currencies, we're going to decide that that is a good currency to start trading. And it's basically like money, but digitalized, and it's not trying to fake it like a banking system. It's like, no, honestly, we're not really worth much, but your value you put on us is what makes us valuable, which is where it gets a little sketchy, and there's a lot of problems there, but yeah.
If I can elaborate, Bobby, one way to think about it is, so fiat money used to be backed by gold, which was worth something, so you could take your bill and you could turn it into a bank for $20 in gold. And then they divorced it from that, and now the bill is just worth $20 and it's not backed by anything. So one way to think about cryptocurrency is, if it becomes more and more of a standalone thing, is now instead of just being backed by dollars, it's just all by itself. So you could think of it as one more step removed from being backed by a gold standard. But in a lot of ways, it's the value comes not because it's based on anything, but because a government or a third party can't control it in the same way.
If I could just briefly point out one other thing. One thing that separates a lot of cryptocurrencies, or why they're even called cryptocurrencies, from cash in your bank account online would be that cryptocurrencies are cryptographically signed. That's why they're considered to be more secure. The relationships between blocks in the blockchain are secure because they're cryptographically signed, which is not true of your bank account, which is just numbers in a database.
All right. Hey, 1 second ago, James, you said that the US dollar used to be backed by gold, and now crypto might be backed by, you know, US dollar, whatever. But isn't gold just backed by consensus just as much as cryptocurrency is backed by consensus? Because gold isn't really intrinsically valuable. It is for, you know, like microchips, we use some gold, but we don't really use it for anything, it's just consensus. So how is the consensus that backs gold different than the consensus that backs cryptocurrency?
First of all, it's about 4,000 years older, which helps. If you do a tradition long enough, it can turn into a law. And then the second thing is, I think gold, Joshua mentioned this, even the Bible very early mentions gold just as being desirable for its beauty and for what you can do with it. So the fact that the temple was plated in, I can't imagine God plating a temple in cryptocurrency. So that, I think you could argue that gold has some inherent worth in and of itself, and because it fits all the criteria for as a medium of exchange, it does have some sort of intrinsic value. Now that can be argued, but I would argue that it does.
Who's next?
I'm wondering if any of the panelists have invested in cryptocurrency at all, and what they chose and why.
I am an investor. A whole $10 worth. I bought Bitcoin on Square Cash, and that was fun. I was like, what will $10 do in a couple days? And immediately, I lost like 20 cents. I'm like, well, shoot. And then I was like, well, I'll just let it sit for a few days. And then I came back. I'm like, oh, I made $3. And then I checked again today. I'm like, oh, I'm at 10. So yeah, it's just kind of a fun experiment. That's about all.
I made about $1,000. Isaiah lost a few thousand. You can talk to either of us about it later.
I just wanted to circle back to Isaiah's question. One of the reasons that gold, in our minds, is the standard to which we appeal in some ways, so our currency used to be backed by gold. The reason gold tends to be the standard that nations use is because it's one of those commodities that matches up better than most other commodities to the seven characteristics of what makes something valuable just by nature. So it's not like people got together and decided like these seven attributes are valuable in a currency. You know, it's a natural way of coming about that. So I think that a lot of your question about being backed, currency being backed by gold, just stems from the fact that gold is something that meets those characteristics. So then the question becomes, with cryptocurrency, it meets some of those characteristics, doesn't meet some of those characteristics, and I don't remember how your question came up, but it was, you know, we go from something backed by a physical commodity to not backed by anything besides trust, really, to whatever cryptocurrency is farther down that line.
All right. Anybody else? Isaac.
Hey. Okay, just making sure I'm not too loud. Just out of curiosity, you guys mentioned that sending cryptocurrency, you could control where it goes or how it's being spent. And you can program it that way. What makes it so strong or so locked away that the people receiving it can't reprogram it to spend it another way?
So just kind of a very brief explanation based on the way Bitcoin works. Basically, this is actually why a lot of Bitcoin transactions take time to go through. It takes sometimes up to 10 minutes for a Bitcoin transaction to be verified. So one of the reasons why this is because, once again, in our ledger, as we're entering items in the ledger, each item is cryptographically tied to the previous item in the ledger. The way that the next item is generated is it has to do a proof of work calculation. So this is why mining Bitcoin burns up your computer, because it's doing these proof of work calculations. So basically what happens is the longer, if you create a transaction, in order to rewrite what's happening in that transaction, you have to rewrite everything that happens after that point in the blockchain. So basically, the longer that the more time passes, the harder and harder it gets, i.e. the more CPU power and CPU work it's going to take in order to change that entire part of the chain. In fact, it's exponential. So after a certain amount of time, it's all but impossible to ever do enough proof of work calculations to catch up, so to speak. So that's why it's almost impossible to hack once a transaction has been verified, once again, about 10 minutes, because Bitcoin specifies that you can't really create more than one block every 10 minutes. Because after that amount of time, the CPU work necessary to actually to change that amount of the ledger would be just incalculable. Is that
sort of on top of that? If you're trying to change the ledger as it's being created, because it pulls from a diverse group of systems, you have to get a 51% majority of the computing power for that blockchain, which, if you think about it, is insanely high. Like, if you do a cost-benefit analysis, it would be cheaper to just go finance some other criminal enterprise instead of buying all the processing power necessary to gain a 51% majority.
That also comes back to the decentralized system is that prevents, like the clipboard analogy I used, it prevents me from being able to be like, no, this cryptocurrency is going to be doing this. My Bitcoin will be doing this. And or I completely make up one, or I duplicate another one. The as soon as I do that, and I'm like, okay, I'm sending it to, say, James Schrouse. And then you all look at your clipboard, and you're like, actually, Stocker, you don't own that cryptocurrency. You don't own that Bitcoin, because in the blockchain, it's never been accounted that, and it's never been sent to your address. So it totally prevents you from being able to, put out any counterfeit system or anything like that, which helps with the whole hacking problems.
Right.
So I've kind of got a two-part question.
Oh boy.
How in the world are we supposed to buy and sell things with cryptocurrency if, say, our phone goes out? Is there like a debit card sort of thing that we can use to buy things, so we're not reliant on a phone? And also, what would be the effects of an EMP on cryptocurrency?
First, you got to come up with an EMP. So I think we can worry about that when we get there. As far as doing it without a computer, I don't know.
It's the same problem we face with our modern credit card, debit card. Everything is pretty much the same as unstable to an EMP. That's that puts banking systems, that puts pretty much everything in our society out of business if that happens. But I think there's companies coming into cities like New York right now who are starting ATMs for Bitcoin specifically. And you can go up to it and you can exchange your cash for Bitcoin, and then it dumps onto your phone. And then that's your virtual wallet. So yeah, if right now, if you lost your phone or if you destroyed it or it ran out of batteries, you'd kind of be like, well, shucks, that's not good. But I'm pretty sure the developments will come up with something new, because I mean, if you lost your coin purse back in, you know, Roman times, you're like, well, I'm dying because I can't eat for the next month. There's going to be a lot of new developments that can happen that, you know, prevent that from happening. But at the moment, those are starting to develop and they will be here soon.
And another thing is, when you have your public address, you can use that to access whatever money you have from anywhere. So if your internet personally goes down, you can always access from a library computer or anything like that. So I guess the biggest problem would be if there is a major internet shutdown. But even in that case, say you invested a lot in Bitcoin, and there's a major internet shutdown, you still own that Bitcoin. Like, nothing can really happen to the ledger since it is decentralized. Nothing is going to be happening to your money while the internet's down. So.
Sasha?
So you talk about cryptocurrency being very secure through this blockchain tracking currency, but then you also talk about it being very anonymous. How does that fit together, that, oh, you can make sure your Bitcoin's not being hacked, but you can also make sure that no one knows it was you spending your Bitcoin?
Yeah, we didn't really cover that part because it's a little complicated, but we could try.
Just to briefly answer, each transaction is not necessarily connected with your person. Like, you have to use the Bitcoin system, and you are the one who can access your account on the Bitcoin system. The governments or whoever's trying to persecute you for a crime might not necessarily know or be able to prove that it is you, the individual, who is accessing that account. So it gives a gray area. You can say, in order to prove someone guilty, because like innocent until proven guilty, in order to prove someone guilty, you'd have to trace it down directly. And one of the only ways of doing that is either to get into the Bitcoin system itself, in which case Bitcoin becomes or gains all the same problems that a fiat currency dependent upon a government has, or you have to force that individual into revealing that, yes, I'm connected to this account, which you could do that theoretically, but if the individual weighs in their own mind that it is more beneficial not to admit to or to connect themselves to that, I don't think you'd be able to coerce them into doing so. Outside of... it wouldn't be any different than torturing someone to get a confession, per se.
Now you know why the anarchists like it.
All right. Also, I don't know if someone maybe who's more familiar with this could correct me on this, but it's my understanding that our transactions with Bitcoin primarily identified by basically just the signature of your private key, not by any kind of information that's directly connected to your person. So therefore, it's secure because of your private key, but you're not. There's nothing that necessarily connects that with you without some kind of external intervention like the police or whatever.
So you briefly mentioned that Bitcoin could be mined. If it's something that's mined, what keeps it from being inflated? And how is it mined at all? Because it's just digital?
So the mining process is basically kicking down blockchain doors. And you run super complicated things on your computer, and it finds the key that you need to open a blockchain. And as soon as you open that up, you're rewarded with 25 bitcoins, which can't be duplicated or anything like that. What keeps this from inflating is that there is only a limited amount of bitcoin. So there's only some...
What's 21 million?
21 million bitcoin out there, and we probably won't find any... Well, we won't find them all until 2140 is the prediction. But... And that's because every time you mine a Bitcoin, it gets a little bit harder to do it again. So there's companies like in China that are running who mine about 100 Bitcoin a day, and it costs them 80,000 in electric a month. And so it's like this very complicated process where eventually it's going to get less and less efficient. And so it's actually deflation, because you end up with a little bit of currency, and that has to be divided out in very small fractions. Like, I own 0.00000012% of a Bitcoin. And it's like, okay, I own nothing. But how it keeps from inflating is not that there's an endless amount that can just be printed and printed and printed like our government does with everything. And they're so limited of it that we're like, oh, we just have to make do with what we've got.
Also, just note, it is theoretically possible to inflate it. Once again, if a government through regulation were able to get 51% of the computing power, they could change the rules for how you're rewarded with Bitcoin for doing proof of work problems, which are the problems that your computer has to solve to knock down the blockchain doors, as Stalker put it. So it's theoretically possible to change those rules, but as we've noted, it's extremely hard to do so, because you would have to have 51% or more of CPU processing power, which in this decentralized world is extremely difficult.
How did anyone manage to persuade the first person to spend lots of time on a computer to get a Bitcoin? I mean, it seems like a remarkable con exercise, actually. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, okay. So the original Bitcoin was only worth, back in 2008, was like 0.0008 cents. So it was worth hardly nothing. But you could mine it on your laptop. You could just run a little quick thing. It's like, oh, mine a Bitcoin. And it'd do it like, oh, I got you 100 Bitcoins. Isn't that neat? And you're like, oh, that took nothing. But because of its ever complicating process, that's why it's so expensive to do it now. But it opened the door. People were just like, oh yeah, I can mine some Bitcoin on my free time. I mean, it's like, just let my laptop run it for a little while. And then that eventually led to the discovery, like, oh, actually, I can mine it a lot faster if I run a gaming graphics card. And it's like, oh, look, I got like 3 extra Bitcoin today rather than 2. And it was immediately rewarding for just solving it. So you didn't have people who were just, you know, like, oh, I'm bored and I have nothing to do. That was part of it, but... it got big enough to where now people care about it and are like, oh yeah, I'm gonna write a thesis on it, or get everyone in my class to buy some. Like, I was convinced a couple of years ago, but I didn't. Fool.
think it's also important to note that the problem of digital currency has been something that people have been trying to figure out basically ever since the internet was around. So Bitcoin was itself simply another iteration of a process that people have been trying to figure out for a long time. People have been trying to figure out, how do we use our computers to, you know, we have things like e-gold, et cetera, or previous versions of this idea. So Bitcoin had, there was a history of people trying to figure out how to create a currency that was only purely backed by some kind of digital algorithm. So there was already some basis of interest there when Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever that is, published the original Bitcoin white paper in 2008.
That help? But you still wouldn't buy it yourself. All right. We got Emma right here, Cooper, in the middle.
I know my parents are really uncomfortable with the idea of Bitcoin. Do you think it'll take a generational shift before the mass of people will be able to use this as a currency? Or do you think it's an idea that we could convince those older than us to take up?
Well, the internet worked out all right.
This is really theoretical, but I guess my answer would be we've already seen the rapid shift in technology even over the last 20 years. So, I mean, my grandparents have an iPad. So, in a sense, I'm sure there are some people from older generations who would find the idea intriguing. But then again, I don't think it's necessarily going to take a full generational shift. If this is if cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, is something that sticks around for a while.
And I think part of it is that cryptocurrency is just so unstable right now, and it seems like younger people are more willing to take those risks in hopes of it turning into something great in the future. And so I think if it were to eventually become stable, it would be easier to get other people on board as well that were less risk prone.
Well, all of this is assuming that it will take off. Sorry. Which, it's not clear that it will. I mean, I might be the only naysayer here, but honestly, cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin especially, look like a huge bubble. They really do. And what you see is a mass, you see the movement of the masses just flocking towards this new thing, and its value is just, the momentum is just people creating interest in it, and investors trying to cash out quickly since it's gaining value. It's at this point, Bitcoin, the original Bitcoin, is worthless as a currency. You can't use it to buy anything. You just can't use it as a currency because transaction times are so slow, and the waiting lines to enter into the block, into a new block, are so long. I think they run to the thousands. That at this point, I don't remember what financial group just determined that it's really just a speculative commodity, which basically means it's no different than a stock. So as a currency, Bitcoin is useless.
Well, not to start too long of an argument, but I would note, first of all, the transaction times are not an essential part of cryptocurrency as a concept. For example, Ethereum, one of its biggest selling points was the fact that transaction times are extremely low. The transaction times point has actually been a problem of Bitcoin. Bitcoin was its most popular perhaps because it was the most original cryptocurrency, but perhaps as a result of also being original, it is also liable to a lot of criticisms. So I think we need to separate, it is important to separate the idea of Bitcoin itself from cryptocurrency as a concept. Cryptocurrency is simply a concept that's trying to solve problems in the digital currency marketplace. Also, there is a growing list of over 100 major companies now that actually accept Bitcoin directly, so there is some traction, but
Additionally, I think it's important to remember where we are now, where we're coming from. When people are looking towards Bitcoin, what do we have? We have a fiat currency where the government can print money whenever they want to. People have been arguing, like when the US dollar went off the gold standard, there was argument there, but it happened. This may be the case with Bitcoin. Maybe we're going to start trading in Bitcoin and the US dollar will fall away. I personally think we'll need some sort of crash before we sort of like jumpstart the economy into Bitcoin, if it's going to work.
Cryptocurrency.
No, but either way, we still need to think about the issue, see all the problems that are with it, and as Christians, act in a way that pleases God.
I was just going to say that there's also an important distinction to make about where the value of cryptocurrency comes from. Because like Joshua said, a Bitcoin really has zero intrinsic value besides like the value people place on it. And what's valuable is the system. And the system, as it is currently, at least for Bitcoin, is buggy enough that we need to figure out a lot of those issues. Like it may be transaction times, but the idea behind the system is where the value really comes from, not the coin itself. So.
And also, I think it's more likely if cryptocurrency is going to survive, that governments will start minting their own. It's like, it seems more likely, well, as we all know, governments are more interested in your taxes than anything else, or something like that. But when it comes to cryptocurrencies, governments obviously want a slice of the pie, and it seems it is something to note that a dollar technically, theoretically, could become a cryptocurrency. It just needs to have a lot of pre-mining and other concepts that I don't quite understand. But theoretically, it could be the case. So, and I think that's more realistic.
Yeah. Nate? Oh, John, sorry.
What exactly is happening when the value of cryptocurrency drastically increases?
Its value goes up.
Well, it's the same thing as, like, if you look at the, it's basically any kind of other commodity trading. Like, people will do this actually with the exchange rate of the dollar and the pound. People do this with gold and silver. People do this with gasoline. People do it with corn. It's any kind of commodity trading. You're just basically betting that, so when you're buying into Bitcoin, I'm just simply betting that the value of Bitcoin will go up so that I can then sell out and buy more dollars. And so this kind of brings me back to what I mentioned in my presentation, where I mentioned that it's like gold. We say, a lot of people say that gold's a really bad investment, but it's a really good currency or a really good basis for a currency, because it shares the elements of, it shares the seven elements of money that we want to see, like we heard about. But on the other hand, when it's not being used as money, if you're just betting on it, you're basically just playing the lottery with other people. So that's why when you're betting against the exchange rate, it changes all the time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's unstable as a currency, just like gold.
How are we doing on time? One more. Okay, Nate, make it a good one.
All right. You guys seem to be saying that the value of Bitcoin increases as the user base increases. Is that fair to say? Okay. And James and Tristan both mentioned that Bitcoin can currently be used to negotiate rather shady deals on the deep web, such as hiring a hitman. So, as a Christian, how ethical is it for me to invest in and validate a currency that could potentially one day be used to place a bounty on Knox Merkel's head?
Well, if you're...
First off, Nate, you can do that now because you can do it in United States dollars. And I'm pretty sure you could pay somebody in United States dollars to shoot Knox.
And if you are worried about the morality of investing in a certain cryptocurrency, there is the Christ coin for you. You can look it up. It's a cryptocurrency for Christians. You can use it to tithe.
All right. Well, this has been fun. I do want to make sure that our panelists get the recognition they deserve, but I will point out that all of us were on teams. We all collaborated with everybody else. The whole class worked on this, so this was not just us. A lot of people put a lot of time into all of this. But to our panelists, thank you very much for all the work you put in.
I'm a 2009 graduate of New St. Andrews College, and I'm a commercial property manager.
Three kids at Logos, one at home still, and I do flowers on the side out of our house. When you have these little people that you're responsible to shepherd, you realize I need to know what I'm talking about because they need to have a firm foundation and they need deep roots so that they don't get blown over and that they're ready to stand up for the truth.
I am a programmer. The language aspect of NSA is a fantastic preparation for any sort of programming.
I'm a real estate broker here in town. I think absolutely the perfect education for being in sales of really any kind.
I actually put it to a lot of great use when I was working in the political realm.
I am a pastor in Central Coast, California. Whatever vocation you take, it'll make you take that seriously because you're seeing it through the lens of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ.
To learn more, visit us online at nsa.edu.